You know what today is? Today is Wednesday. It's anything can happen day.
Mr. Angel, allow me to introduce my client, Monsieur Louis Sackfer.
Do you by chance remember the name Johnny Favorite?
Am I supposed to know him?
Monsieur Sackfer has a contract. Certain collateral was involved to be forfeited in the event of his death.
You must want this Johnny pretty mad, huh?
I don't like messy accounts.
You want me to check it out?
Check it out.
Who are you?
I'm just the guy who was paid to snoop around.
He's dead, Mr. Angel. And if he isn't, he is to me.
Very pretty girl, Epiphany. Your name suits you. I'm looking for a friend of your mama's, guy called Johnny Favorite.
Johnny Favorite was as close to true evil as she ever wanted to come.
There's a lot of religion going around with this thing. It's very weird. And I don't understand it. It's ugly.
They say there's just enough religion in the world to make men hate one another, but not enough to make them love.
Hey, look, I took on a $125 a day missing persons job with you, all right? Now I'm a murder suspect. That's it. I'm out.
Are you afraid?
Yeah, I'm afraid.
You know, some religions think that the egg is the symbol of the soul. Did you know that?
No, I didn't know that.
Would you like an egg? The flesh is weak, Johnny. Only the soul is immortal.
And yours belongs to me.
I know who I am. Louis Cipher. Lucifer. Even your name is a Dime Store joke. I know who I am!
How terrible is wisdom when it brings no profit to the wise, Johnny.
I know who I am!
So it's 1955, and I believe it's Brooklyn, and it feels like that, but every decade belongs to the last, so it actually kind of feels like 1940s Brooklyn, or at least an impression of it. And we meet Harry Angel, a downtrodden, soup-stained private eye who chases insurance fraud and cheating husbands, somehow summoned to the office of a lawyer named Winesap and a mysterious benefactor named Louis Cipher, and is commissioned by a grand sum of money, or at least more money than Angel's used to find a crooner that disappeared before the war named Johnny Favorite. And thus starts Alan Parker's 1987 adaptation of William Hjortsberg's novel Falling Angel, Angel Heart, one of my all-time favorite motion pictures.
That was Chris Alexander talking about the neo-noir horror film Angel Heart. Mr. Alexander is a filmmaker, musician, and film critic who served as the editor-in-chief of legendary horror magazine Fangoria for 6 years and is currently acting as the managing editor of horror website Shock Till You Drop. In addition, Mr. Alexander is the editor-in-chief of the excellent horror mag Delirium, which he helped create with Full Moon's Charles Band. Mr. Alexander, thanks so much for being on the show.
We're talking about Angel Heart. The pleasure is all mine. Thank you.
So I got to ask, out of any horror movie you might have chosen to discuss, why go with Angel Heart?
I saw Angel Heart at the right time. Most of my favorite movies you see when you're at your most open and vulnerable, and I think that's when you're on the cusp of puberty and you're starting to leave one world and enter a much more dangerous and volatile next world. And so it's subjective, of course, but I saw Angel Heart when I was 12, and the movie stuck with me. And I pretty much defined the way I watch movies, and that is that Angel Heart is kind of genreless. You can call it a horror movie, sure, but it's also a noir. It's a psycho thriller. It's almost a Tennessee Williams-esque bizarre chamber drama. It's all kinds of different things. It's its own thing, you know? And those are my favorite kinds of movies, those ambiguous, moody, atmospheric, psychological, and strange pictures that really defy easy classification. So Angel Heart has always stuck with me. I can watch Angel Heart. Well, sometimes you can just keep it on in the background. It's kind of sort of a friend that keeps you company. You don't have to watch it, or at least I don't have to watch it anymore. But I certainly revisit it often, and I always find something or hear something I missed the time before. So it's a movie that I'll probably carry to my grave.
You know, it is as great a blending of genres I think I've ever seen in a film. I mean, you know, Parker manages to nail noir and horror, you know, not merely in the same movie, but often sometimes in the same frame. You know, the lighting and photography usually evoke old detective movies, but there's that dread that's instilled in every moment once Angel is given his case.
Yeah, I mean, even from the beginning, it's actually instilled right from the opening. And you know, Parker always knows how to use music. And we know, you know, from all his films, going back to Midnight Express with the Giorgio Moroder music, and then, of course, Pink Floyd's The Wall, Even later films like Angela's Ashes, he really knows how to use music to be evocative and use it as a character. And when we hear that that Courtney Pine saxophone playing the old big band song "Girl of My Dreams," while a drone kind of throbs in the background at the very opening of the film, as soon as it fades in from black with those whispers of "Johnny, Harry," and we see a dead body lying in this gutter. I mean, we know we're entering the bowels of hell, and we're not going to get out easy. So there's a feeling of dread and that something is wrong, literally right from the first seconds of the film. And I think he maintains that. I think that's the beauty of the movie, is that it's almost unrelenting. It maintains that single pulse of dread right until the very end. It's a very kind of quiet and understated film, so that when things do happen, and they do, you feel them even more because they break that hypnotic monotony that the movie revels in, you know?
You know, a great way to sort of get us into that world, in addition to the music, I think, is our initial introduction to Angel himself. You know, I mean, the first time he walks on screen, you can tell he has that sort of typical tough private eye swagger in a way. But he also allows, you know, Rourke's performance allows the character to be sort of vulnerable, too. You know, not just in the final half when the horror really starts to intensify, but, you know, even early on after the first murder, you know, there's that great moment when Cypher asks Angel if he's scared. And, you know, how great is that the writing allows for Rourke to answer, "Yeah, I'm scared," with no hesitation whatsoever. You know, it immediately sort of endears Angel, I think, to the audience, because he's a hero that feels, you know, kind of the exact same way we do about the crazy tale he's navigating, you know, rather than just posturing and being a two-fisted hero throughout. And, you know, even when there is an action scene later on in the movie and he is, you know, ambushed early on, he's not a very good fighter. He sort of just runs away.
No, you're right. So, I mean, you know, credit this. This was pretty much, this is 1987, Mickey Rourke being one of the hottest actors of the 80s and just about to hit his decline. I think maybe Homeboy, or was that what it was called, the boxing one, would be the kind of the pushover. By the time he got to Wild Orchid, it was a free fall. But, you know, this is kind of the last great Mickey Rourke role before The Wrestler, in that Rourke is just being Rourke, you know? I mean, nobody did that better than him, sort of downtrodden, a little bit on the skids, not quite ready for the ball, and yet there's a sweetness in his eyes, a sort of, you know, before his face got all fucked up and mangled, and there's a kind of a gentleness to Rourke's face that really lends itself to the character. Harry Angel's a good man, you know, he may be trapped in a bad world and can hang out with some unsavory people, and even resort to some kind of, you know, gutter tactics in order to get his man, quote unquote, but he's a good human being, which makes the sting at the end of the films that much more profound. But this is Rourke's deal, and he's effortless. You know, there's the commentary on the first DVD release of this film. I don't know if you ever saw it. And Rourke is sitting in a screening room holding one of his chihuahuas.
Oh yeah,
and remember that? They call it a non-commentary because he doesn't remember anything. He did this movie. He just kind of breezed in, and, you know, really didn't have to be directed too much. He just kind of became this persona. It was almost like the movie was written for him in many respects, which of course it wasn't. But if you read the book, I don't know if you've read the book.
Ages ago, it seems like, at least 10 or 12 years ago, around the same time that the special edition DVD came out. And I think it was roughly around the same time, too, that I discovered that the writer was the same guy who wrote Ridley Scott's Legend. So it was kind of a must read for me at that point.
Yeah, Hjortsberg. What a great guy. But, you know, the novel is much more of a hard-boiled kind of Mickey Spillane kind of deal. And the version of Harry Angel there is much more of a slob, you know, a little more obese, a little more cold around the heart, a little less vulnerable. And so the movie always feels to me like someone read the novel, fell asleep, and had this kind of waking dream about it. Because it's an impression of the novel. So the version of Angel we get in the film is very much Rourke's Harry Angel, radically different than Hjortsberg's original vision of the character, I think.
Yeah, and, you know, from the first time we see him, you know, he walks out onto that city street. You know, he's a handsome guy. He has the long coat. He looks like he hasn't slept well. And if he did, you know, it's probably in the clothes he was wearing. But, you know, he's even smoking a cigarette while chewing bubble gum. You know,
yeah.
And, you know, he has that slight cut on his cheek early on, you know, and one can imagine that maybe it's from a previous case that might have gone wrong. But, you know, from the moment that you see him, it feels like Angel might have been in many previous adventures, you know, prior to the events of this film, not unlike, you know, a Mike Hammer, as it were.
Yeah. Yeah. But the thing is about Angel, what I've always gleaned from the character is that he's always been, you know, a real gumshoe, a real, you know, kind of D-lister. I mean, even he's shocked when Cypher and Weinsapp hire him. He figures that you must have just found me out of the phone book, right? Because I'm Angel, so I'm top of the list. Like, why would you choose me? I'm a kind of a low-end private eye. I do the shitty little small cases that no one cares about. Nothing with high stakes, and certainly no cases where anyone's life is on the line. So you can imagine that this guy has kind of spent his life, you know, just kind of eking out this living, a working-class blue-collar private dick. And again, that makes him more endearing, and also makes the fact that he's thrust into this arcane world that he doesn't quite comprehend all the more effective in the film.
Absolutely. And Rourke is so great in that role. I kind of miss that that Mickey Rourke in a way. It feels like we have two Mickey Rourkes in film, you know, history, as it were. But, you know, in doing research for this chat, I found that apparently Robert De Niro was initially considered for Angel as well as Jack Nicholson. And I cannot imagine the film with either one of those actors. I mean, you know, De Niro in the Angel role, that is. But how do you feel that might have affected the movie had either one of those guys been cast?
Well, these are hard questions to ask, right? Because you hear this about every major film where this could have been this person and this could have been that person. I mean, I think it was even Mary Poppins. Wasn't that supposed to be Audrey Hepburn at one point? You're like, well, what? Who? What? Where? And, so, you know, it's hard to kind of reimagine something that's got such a strong DNA with somebody else pulling the strings. I remember Cronenberg's Dead Ringers was supposed to have De Niro in the role at one point too, but you can't imagine anyone other than Jeremy Irons playing the Mantle twins, because
I did not know that. Wow.
Yeah, they are the film. So Angel Heart is such a unique, fascinating one shot. I think a lot of people have maybe tried to allude to it or quote it or imitate it, but no one can. It's just such an amazing amalgam of different elements that just kind of came together, whether by design or accident or whatever. You know, all the great films of all time are essentially built by happy accidents. So whatever cosmic energy brought this movie together, and that includes Cosby Girl, Lisa Bonet, in the role as Epiphany Proudfoot. I mean, everything in this movie just works in the confines of the universe that Parker builds. I can't imagine anyone else being Harry Angel. And you know, to me, that iconic shot of him, I think it's on the soundtrack album. It's a black and white, silver-toned black and white shot where his eyes are half closed and he's exhaling a plume of smoke and it's just kind of coming around the sides of his face. And to me, that's the quintessential Mickey Rourke portrait. It also represents everything I love about the film, and the sound of it, the look of it, the smell of it even. I mean, that's just the way the movie is. It feels like it's being beamed in from another universe or has been excavated from some time capsule, and it exists there with no easy explanations. You know, I mean, it's still a very ambiguous film that doesn't overplay its hand, and it has a certain kind of, well, literal voodoo that I don't think any other movie does. So I can't imagine another person in the role. I certainly can't close my eyes and think of Louis Cypher playing Harry Angel. It just doesn't work. It would be a radically different picture, that's for sure.
But De Niro, you know, he is excellent as Louis Cypher. I mean, you know, he brings sort of like an intelligence, certainly, but even kind of a charm to his version of, you know, essentially the devil. And, you know, one almost wishes that he had had more time in the film, though, you know, the story doesn't really require it. And, you know, I was thinking about De Niro. He doesn't often play around in the genre that much, but he's always interesting when he does, even when the film isn't so great. You know, I'm thinking of his work as the creature in Branagh's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, which I adore that movie. I love that flick. But or even movies like Godsend and Hide and Seek, you know, the movies may not be, you know, so great, but he's always very interesting in them.
Yeah, I think De Niro. De Niro gets a lot of flack by snotty-nosed hipsters for being some of his choices these days. But you know what? He's paid his dues. He can do whatever the fuck he wants, and he's always good. And I don't care if he's in Meet the Fockers. He's still funny and he's still good. He's good in everything. He's a great actor. Full stop. I mean, I'm enjoying this you know, elderly version of De Niro. I watched The Intern with you know, I watch all movies. I don't care. You know, horror is my wheelhouse, but I'll watch anything. And The Intern with what's her face? I forget her name now. Anne Hathaway and De Niro, and I think it's one of the most charming movies I've seen in a long time, and De Niro was fantastic in it. I watched another movie with Jennifer Lawrence called Joy made by the guy, what's his name, David O. Russell, about the woman who invented this mop. I mean, Sam's mundane and pedestrian. De Niro's in it. He steals the movie. He's fantastic. So I love De Niro and everything he does. But, you know, to me, one of the greatest horror films of all time is Taxi Driver, even though it's not considered a horror film. And I think there's a lot of Taxi Driver's DNA in Angel Heart as well. It kind of feels like a great companion movie. And it's almost like Travis Bickle has become the devil in Angel Heart. You know, he has the same, he has that same kind of like leer, but he's much more obviously in control. Bickle is a sociopath. He's a loose cannon. But, you know, what I love about watching De Niro in Angel Heart is that he's channeling his director from Taxi Driver, Scorsese. He's trying to even look like Martin Scorsese did circa 1976 with the black, jet black beard and hair and that look. He's trying to look like him. It's his homage to his one of his mentors. But yeah, I love
considered that. Wow.
Oh yeah. That's verbatim. That is the truth. Actually, that is exactly what he designed it as, a sort of a kind of a nudge and a wink to Scorsese. But what I love about De Niro as Cypher is that he's having fun. He's having a blast. The movie's so dour and so dark and such a down spiral, emotional quagmire. But you know, the devil's pulling the strings, and that's in the novel too. The devil is orchestrating this opera. He is the guy that's putting all the players into place and propelling the whole narrative just because he can. You know, it'd be very easy from him from the outset. So, hey, Mr. Angel, remember, I'm the devil, you're Johnny Favorite. Come on, let's go. But he doesn't want to. He wants to toy. He's like a cat toying with his prey and enjoying every second of it because he's got no risk. There's no chance that he's going to lose control of this game. And I love that. I love that glee that, you know, it's, I forget what the term is, but the audience isn't aware of what's going on, but the characters are. They know everything. And it's clear right from the beginning. The only person who's in on everything that's going to happen from frame one to frame none is Louis Cypher. And De Niro captures that beautifully.
Yeah, and I love how he plays the delight in messing with Angel throughout, you know, even down to that great scene. I believe it's their second meeting when, you know, when he's just eating the egg after having described, you know, I mean, that's so twisted in a way, but it's so beautifully played on De Niro's part.
Yeah. Yeah. He, you know, the way it even cracks, I mean, it's just, you get the sound design too, the little crack of the shell as he's rolling it. And he alludes to the fact that the egg represents a soul. And then he offers Harry Angel the egg. Would you like an egg, Mr. Angel? I mean, everything about it is just so dripping with, as you say, charm. But a grinning, gleeful evil. It's one of the great portrayals of the devil on screen.
Yeah, how do you feel about the name that's given to him in this, Louis Cypher, which even the movie notes is a
dime store joke.
Yes, which is so great. But, you know, it sort of gives away that twist immediately, if one would even consider it a twist. You know, I mean, I feel almost like as a modern viewer who discovered that movie much later on as a film fan, you know, it's obvious from the start that he is the devil. And yet, do you think that was Parker's intention? Were they trying to hide that at all? Or do you think that they're telling the audience from the off that this is absolutely what's going on? This is who he is.
Yeah, I don't think, well, obviously, it's not necessarily Parker. It's Schwartzberg, because that's right in the novel. And the novel is a very deliberate, not, I won't say campy, but it's a deliberate blackly humorous quote on pulp novels. So, you know, that kind of cheap gimmick, which Angel even addresses at the end, as you say, but even your joke is, even your name is a dime store joke. You know, I think that the movie's in on that joke. And I think Angel Heart does have a sense of black humor about it. Certainly there are some genuinely bleakly funny moments in it. And certainly the novel was funny too. So I think having the name Louis Cypher in there as kind of is there by design, obviously, and it is very in on its own joke and its tackiness, and that it is presenting the audience the solution to the puzzle right there. And whether or not they choose to recognize that or not, you know, and I know there's a lot of spoilers we're giving away right now in this piece. Presumably everyone's seen it who's listening. But, you know, they do. All the arrows point to what's going on right at the beginning. And then there are other clues as the movie goes on that will allow the audience to kind of solve the mystery, so to speak. But I like that. I think it's kind of brash and pulpy and fun that he's called Louis Cypher. Certainly it's something I don't even question anymore. The only thing that I may think about the movie that if there was anything I could go back and alter in that film, and I don't think I ever would, because if it's in the movie, it exists in the film, you accept it, the movie on its own terms. But the only thing I would ever alter is towards the very end of the film, when whatever powers that be decided in post-production to give both the child and Cypher glowing yellow eyes, you know, and they don't quite match the eyes, so they kind of, the optical effect is a bit shoddy because they kind of bounce a little bit. The movie doesn't need that, you know. And I think that's the only part in the film that I would personally, if it was ever re-released in some way, shape, or form, maybe find a way to obliterate that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it, you know, for a movie so carefully built on mood and so carefully crafted as a period piece, I mean, those two moments where they're so obvious. So obviously visual effects, I mean, it nearly destroys the film, I think, in those moments.
Yeah, I mean, it's the climactic moment and, you know, the wallop of the ending, which I guess we can say it here, when he finds out that he's been hunting himself, that he's fucked his own daughter, that he's murdered his own daughter, who's also his lover. And then, you know, it all just kind of comes to that climax where he's riding the elevator down to hell. And just to have that little cheap, I mean, it's such a great movie betraying typical horror cliches and conventions, to throw in this little like booga booga moment, really just kind of makes it go, well, I don't know about that. You didn't need that. We really didn't need to be reminded that we're watching a horror movie. Oh yeah, it's the devil, so we got to throw the red eyes or the red or yellow. I don't remember. I think they're yellow, aren't they?
I think yellow, yes.
Yeah, yeah. You just don't need it. I mean, I accept it now, and you can kind of giggle at it a little bit, and it doesn't ruin the ultimate effect of the movie. And that ending still gets me every time. When I was a kid, so I should mention, like, again, how I used to watch movies and consume them, and I've written about this ad nauseum, so anyone who's read all my stuff through the years is probably going, oh my god, not again. But it's true. I would watch movies late at night, and I would you know, stay up really late, and I'd sleep with an alarm clock under my pillow and get up before I had a VCR to watch movies. I'd circle the TV guide, and Angel Heart was always on cable. On, you know, in Canada we had didn't have HBO, but we had something called Super Channel, First Choice Super Channel, and it was always on, but it was always on really late at night, so I'd always try to stay up and watch it, and I'd catch it in little bits and pieces, and but I'd always fall asleep because it has that somnambulist kind of rhythm to it, and I'd wake up right at the end with the saxophone blaring and Angel going down to hell in that elevator with the credits rolling, you know, or the credits coming up in those bursts. And it used to horrify me. I couldn't go back to sleep. I was haunted, and I made it my mission. I had to watch the entire film. And so that ending is still, to me, as soon as he gets there and he says those final words, he says, I know, in hell, and the gate closes on him and down he goes. I still, even just talking about it, I get shivers. So yellow eyes or not, I forgive the yellow eyes, and I think the movie still works, even with or without them.
Yeah, I agree. You know, we were talking about Rourke and De Niro. I think it's probably worth talking a moment about Lisa Bonet, who is so great as Epiphany in the film. I mean, she gives a great performance. And, you know, doing a bit of research again for this chat that I remembered, or, you know, rediscovered rather, that there was such a controversy about her being cast in the film, and that, you know, the infamous sex scene, because she was on The Cosby Show at the time. And, you know, I was just wondering, do you imagine that in this day and time, do you think an actress would come under, you know, a similar sort of fire in a similar circumstance today, do you think?
I don't think so, because we're in such a radically different world where, I mean, the biggest television shows on TV tend to be stemming from cable when things are a little bit more explicit. I don't think we get that, you know, the world of Family Ties and The Cosby Show and all these kind of squeaky clean American sitcoms is kind of dead. There's no such thing, I don't think, as a squeaky clean American sitcom. I could be wrong. I don't watch sitcoms anymore. I don't even know if there are any contemporary sitcoms that were trying to perpetuate that illusion of the American family like those shows were. So I think that we live in such a radically different world than we would let that go. I mean, even when people like Miley Cyrus are breaking their traditional Disney roles and sticking their tongues out and shaking their asses, and it's just different. We go on. We accepted Gobble Gobble. We go on. It's different. But we know with Bonet, the whole deal there was Cosby, and it's funny to look back on that now that we know what we know about Bill Cosby, was so in control of that show, trying to perpetuate again that Cosby Kid illusion. He was the one that really fucked things up for her. It wasn't so much that the America or the audience was aghast that Lisa Bonet was in this movie. It's that he was trying to stop it from happening. And she had to kind of fight him to do this. And then he would passive aggressively sort of, I mean, that season he wrote her out of the show, right? Where Denise, her character, ended up going to college and would only appear once in a while via telephone call. And that was all Cosby just completely punishing her for doing this movie. What a piece of shit hypocrite he was and is. So, you know, that's kind of amusing in and of itself. But it added to the film's gravitas. You know, the movie when it came out was dangerous in many respects because of that, because of her presence and because of that sex scene, which really isn't much when you watch it now. But it was, that was a big deal back then. You know, it was, I think it was Roger Ebert who kind of came out and said, whoa, why are you rating this X? Why are you changing this? What? And it, wasn't that the birth of the NC-17? Wasn't Angel Heart instrumental?
I know it was definitely given an X before it had to be cut back to an R. I'm not certain what the actual, the first NC-17 film was.
Well, and that may have been Henry. That may have been Henry and June, actually, if I'm not mistaken. But yes. I think what was going on with Angel Heart and Ebert fighting against that and saying, you know, the scene is instrumental, the impact of it for the character in the film, and this is not a piece of pornography. This is a legitimate motion picture. How can you slap an X on this movie? It doesn't make any sense at all. And I think it was that argument that kind of paved the way for the birth of the NC-17. I think Henry and June, if I'm not mistaken, is like 89 or 90, Angel Heart 87. So, so that was a big deal. And, you know, I remember who released it on Live, L-I-V-E, released it on VHS, and they released the unrated version. And that was also kind of a new thing for a Hollywood film to have an unrated version released on video. And then you get to see what you saw, and it was only a couple other seconds of Rourke's ass pumping into her and a little bit more blood on her boobs, and that was about it. You know, it's really, really innocuous ultimately.
You know, it's crazy to think, too, that it would be, you know, I think that is interesting that this movie might have, in its way, given birth to the NC-17 rating, but it's such a shame that ultimately that rating wound up being useless, arguably because of Showgirls being released and sort of, you know, killing any legitimacy that that rating might have. Because, you know, I worked at a big chain theater for about a decade and a half, and it was a Cinemark chain, and I didn't realize this. I don't think I'd ever considered it, but larger chains will not run NC-17 rated films, at least certain ones. I think AMC might, but I'm pretty sure that Cinemark and Regal and, you know, probably the other top three or four will not. And it's a shame that, you know, I remember reading in the mid-90s that Ebert was arguing for another rating, like an A rating or adult rating, in addition to the NC-17, because the NC-17 had been so marred by Showgirls at that point that no one would take it seriously. You know, it's when you see that rating, I think most moviegoers see that rating and they equate it to, you know, pornography, as it were. And it's such a shame because there are so many movies. I mean, imagine what the horror landscape would look like if, you know, we could get NC-17 rated horror movies in theaters that aren't necessarily, you know, trading on sexual content so much as violence, you know, which is a silly thing for a movie to be, you know, forbidden from viewers anyway. But yeah, it's, I don't know, that's a weird little tangent to go off on, but it's a
good tangent because I mean, I think I don't even think the NC-7, we're in such a different culture now. I mean, I don't know if you watch The Walking Dead, and we might as well tie it into something contemporary, but
oh my god,
you know, that episode was pulverizing. I mean, the kind of stuff my kids collect, The Walking Dead dolls with the guts hanging out and the eyeball, and it's like that kind of shit when we were kids. Forget it. You had to fight to see Dawn of the Dead. I mean, and especially I'm in Canada, so Dawn of the Dead was, and Day of the Dead. Day of the Dead was cut to shit by the time it was like 20 minutes shorter, and it was literally cut where there was music jumps. Like, there was no rhyme or reason to any of it. And Dawn of the Dead, you couldn't see it at all. You had to drive over to Detroit if you wanted to see Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, wow.
So that stuff was impossible. Now it's on, you know, primetime television. So what is an NC-17 anymore? I mean, to me, it's like you watch stuff like Lars von Trier's Antichrist, where she's cutting off her clit, and I think that gets squeaks out with an R. I mean, I don't think that we live in such a radically different world. I think the whole NC-17 thing's meaningless, and then, of course, the way people digest entertainment anyways these days, you know, their theatrical releases often with horror films not even in the cards, or if it is, it's a brief blip on the radar before being dumped into the small screen and VOD, and or sometimes in reverse, it appears there first. So I don't even know if it even matters anymore, you know.
It is insane, though, to think that, I mean, you know, there is stuff that's being done on television that wouldn't be able to get an R rating and go into theaters right now. I think it's more evidence that the MPAA is a dinosaur. But, you know, are you fully caught up on The Walking Dead? Have you seen this last week's episode?
Yeah, no, I did. I couldn't believe, you know.
There is no way that would make it into 2,500 screens, you know, here in the U.S.
No.
I mean, it's insane.
You know, my it's all about my kids, right? It's so funny because I won't show them Walking Dead. My other guys, though, my 7-year-old's like, it's all about The Walking Dead. But he has never seen it because I won't show it to him. It's not because of the gore, because these guys go on film sets. They see all the blood. They know all this effects, guys. It's all good. But the emotional component of it, I just could never let them endure. It would be too devastating for them to experience that. So they don't watch that show. But they know of it, and Elliot's always trying to ask me, what goes on? What's happening now? What's going on in the show now? Who did Negan kill? And I have to give him kind of like a cute version of the Walking Dead. But he picked up a copy. You know, George Romero lives really close to us, and so they know him, and it's all good. And he picked up a copy of Day of the Dead, and he looked at it. He's like, oh, Dad, this is one of George's. I want to watch Day of the Dead. And my immediate response is, you can't watch it. And I'm like, you know what? Day of the Dead is Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood compared to that episode of The Walking Dead. I mean, that was the obscene, not just because of the level of gore, but the emotional component with Glenn's eye hanging there. It's like, what the fuck? Unbelievable. You know, so we are spoiled. All the stuff we were looking for that was our red badge of courage when we were kids and unrated films and all the feeling that you're watching something dangerous, that stuff's a joke now by today's standards, what's on television. So it is quite unbelievable.
Absolutely. I mean, I was watching episodes of Hannibal and remembering back only 20 years when, you know, Wes Craven could not get his cut of Scream into theaters.
Right.
And then I wound up catching it. It was such a weird thing. Again, another strange tangent. But, you know, I remember when Craven did those interviews in Fangoria when he talked about how much he had to cut out of the movie. And, you know, and I remember thinking that the R-rated cut was still fantastic. But for whatever reason, I remember back then Buena Vista put out a Laserdisc that was fully uncut, and the rental copy of Scream was the R-rated cut. But for whatever reason, the sell-through version of Scream, the one that you could buy for $15 at your local Camelot or FYE, it was the fully uncut version but rated R. And I don't know if that was something that was just slipped by, or I would like to think that Craven was instrumental in doing that. Probably wasn't. But I remember finally being able to see that cut on VHS, which has never hit DVD, by the way, which is just insane to me. I mean, all these years later, we're still having to deal with the R-rated cut on disc. But yeah, I mean, you look at that and you look at the extra stuff that's in his cut of Scream. I mean, you see guts hitting the ground, and you know, I think there's an extra couple of seconds to Tatum getting her head crushed in the garage door, and it's like, that is so unbelievably tame compared to anything that we get now. And I don't know if anything will be, you know, what can shock audiences today, do you think? I mean,
I think what you got to do is just, I don't think the geek show stuff works anymore. People know how this stuff's built, and you know, back then they didn't, and that's when Fangoria was important, you know, when we were kids and reading it, and it really was the wizard behind the curtain. Like, who are these guys inventing these grand illusions? And you didn't know. And when I saw Dawn of the Dead for the first time, and they rip apart the bikers at the end, I was 11. I didn't even know what those things were. I thought they were like these ropes. I didn't know we had those even inside us. So we're not as – I really didn't, and I was so scared and so upset by that movie because of the biology of it. But now – obviously, kids are much more intelligent. They're much more plugged in. They're much more aware of things, which is fine, which is good. So those things don't shock anymore. You know, you go to your local Dollarama, and there's severed heads and arms and legs, and it's just like, whatever. It's just a joke to them. And zombies, again, my kid buys all his Walking Dead toys at Toys R Us, so it doesn't matter. I think the things that shock are the – I think we're a much more sensitive culture. You know, I think we're much more politically correct. I think we're much our cows are becoming more sacred. And I think, you know, The Walking Dead, for instance, it wasn't the Negan smashing their heads to oblivion that was really affected the audience. It was the fact that they were smashing Glenn's head to oblivion, the fact that he was trying to communicate with his wife, the fact that there was this emotional component there. And I think that's really obviously what has really affected the audience. So I don't know what that means for the future of horror filmmaking, But I just know that, you know, and being an editor of a few magazines and things and getting independent films sent to me every day, most of them not very good, especially horror ones, where they're trying to outgore each other and outshock each other. And it's like, it doesn't work anymore, boys. There's no value to it anymore. You can't do it unless you have something else. You got to go and you got to find a taboo that hasn't been busted yet, or that has been busted but then been restored, and you got to push those boundaries. All the great horror films of all time aren't just about Linda Blair barfing soup and stabbing her vagina with a crucifix. They're about breaking the sanctity of the safety of family or some other kind of social trope. I mean, that's where the shock comes, you know. Certainly the goose is the gore, but underneath it, you got to find something else that's sacred to smash. Otherwise, there's no effect, you know.
Can I ask, you mentioned having worked on, magazines. Of course, you were the editor-in-chief of Fangoria for 6 years, and I loved your run on the magazine. And, you know, you're with Delirium now. Can I ask, you know, in this day and age, what horror magazines how can they best serve horror fans, you know, either burgeoning horror fans or veterans? Do you think it's different than it was, say, in the 90s, like the time when I was growing up with Fangoria? Say, I mean, even, you know, I mean, Fangoria hasn't been out in quite a while, and I just read that, you know, Rue Morgue is scaling back to, you know, 6 months a year, and Video Watchdog just went under apparently too. And, you know, as a dyed-in-the-wool horror fan who loves reading horror mags every month, like me personally, I'm kind of concerned. But do you think – is it merely that print is kind of in trouble right now in this day and age? Or do you think that it's the content that's not quite reaching readers in the same way that it used to? Or am I completely wrong about that, do you think?
No. I mean, I think it's just – listen, I took over Fangoria seven years ago. I don't know. It wasn't that long ago, but it feels like a million years ago. But the point is that Tony had been there, Tony Timpone, for years, and he was still kind of editing it and presenting the magazine in the way that he'd been presenting it forever. And that was that Fangoria was, the only, dancer on the floor, which was not the case. And, you know, the internet really, you know, general horror fans trying to get their news. By the time you print the Terror teletype in the pages of Fangoria, that news is old hat. Set reports that you print in the pages of Fangoria, by the time that magazine hits the stands, the movie's already come out. Everyone hates it. Now you're stuck with a shitty magazine with a cover story about a movie that bombed. I mean, there's just the timeliness. It's over. Everything moves so quickly now that people want their information fast. They want to absorb it and spit it out. And it's when, there's so many movies being made. There's so much entertainment that you can't be contemporary anymore when it comes to print. And so what I tried to do initially right from the get-go was kind of broaden it up a little bit, change the idea of what even genre is, and kind of reach back in the vaults, certainly also cover new things, but trying to do it in a less timely manner, especially with Fango, because there were problems for years even before I showed up, in the sense that they were having trouble getting to stands on time. And so I remember during my run, the agony of it, sometimes even dipping into my own pockets, trying to get that thing moving if we had a timely story. And I remember, I think it was It Follows. I sometimes got talked into putting things on the cover I didn't want to. And I liked that movie, but I knew that it wouldn't end up on stands in time because we were having some trouble. But I put It Follows on the cover. And lo and behold, the publisher kind of, you know, did what he did. And the magazine sat around for a long time, subscribers freaking out, the distributors freaking out, everyone freaking out. And by the time it leaked onto stands, It Follows was well gone out of theaters. The buzz was finished. It was over. And that magazine sold nothing. It was only on stands like 2 weeks, and nobody gave a goddamn. So that's the curse of print. And that's not to slam the publisher of Fangoria, because that's across the board. Everyone is struggling to keep the lights on, you know. But in this day and age, people just want their information quick and dirty and spit it out. And so those magazines really can only survive via collector's medium. They can't be mass produced anymore. And if they can't be mass produced anymore, then the advertisers don't want to pay the money to advertise. And if you don't have any advertisers, then you can't pay your staff and you can't pay anybody. So without advertising dollars, you sink. So that's just the way it is. Now, Delirium is my other magazine. And, you know, I run that exactly how I wanted to run it, telling the stories I want to tell, showing what I want to show. We run it really, really lean, only me and Charlie and a couple other people hanging around in the background, mostly just doing it out of love. It costs very little to produce because we print them in smaller batches, and we don't bother with the newsstands. We sell exclusively to the collectors who subscribe and buy them at shows and everything else. And we break even, maybe sometimes a little better than that. So You know, that's the only way to me, print film, especially niche genre stuff, can actually make it to the finish line. The days of mass produced print are maybe not gone entirely, but certainly sleeping for a while we kind of figure out how all this stuff works, the wild west of the internet, how people can monetize that. And, you know, so it's, you know, that's just where we're at. And it's kind of sad. It is, but it's also symbiotic of change, and you got to either roll with it or step off the ladder. And if you choose to roll with it, then you got to radically change how you do business, you know?
Fair enough. And I will say that I'm a big fan of Delirium. I've noticed that your new issue has, is it Nicholas Winding Refn on the cover?
Yeah. We put Nick on the cover, and with a great piece by Joe Yannick from formerly of Diabolik magazine. I'm not sure what he's with Movie Maker now, with Max Weinstein. He's a jack of all trades, writes for me. But he did this incredible interview with Nick, really a complete career retrospective, and it's really is to me the greatest thing I've read about Refn, and Refn being one of my favorite filmmakers.
He's amazing.
I've read a lot. Yeah, he's amazing. He's a crazy guy, but yeah, he's amazing. So this is a great piece, and it's a little bit out of step with normally what we do with Delirium, and I think this issue is our best issue yet. We're 12 issues in, and I really think we're an experimental mag. We're always trying to find out how we're going to do things, and I don't think every issue is the same. They'll kind of break apart. There's no formula yet, and I think that's what makes it interesting. And certainly those early days of Fangoria when I was a kid were interesting too, because Bob Martin was throwing in wrestlers and doing all kinds of weird stuff. Because they didn't know, they weren't slaved to any format. They were just throwing things at the wall and seeing what stuck. And that's kind of like where we're at with Delirium right now. So it's kind of an exciting magazine, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm so sorry, we have gone so far away from Angel Heart, but
sure, we have, yes. Go back.
But I gotta ask, it's gonna sound like I'm knocking the film for suggesting this, and I'm really not, but you know, when you look at Angel Heart, it is one seriously stylish picture. I mean, it's a beautifully made film, but do you think that there is more depth to the movie than meets the eye? Do you think that the film is more style than substance? Or is it simply, is it a simple story told very well? Or do you think that the film's themes give the movie a bit more weight than it gets credit for, do you think?
I think that, you know, the story is very simple. It's a very simple noir setup. But there's deeper meanings there, in the sense that the movie is simply about identity, and you think you know who you are. Nobody ever really knows who they are. Nobody ever really knows anybody. And I think that's simple, but it's deceivingly simple. Like, it's very profound. The movie has no pretensions to be some great piece of art. And what I really, really like about it is that it's really driven by its sound and atmosphere and mood, and spending time with Angel, watching him maneuver in this world, in the sense that there's a lot of room for the viewer to find their own meaning in there. There's certainly little clues and hints and symbols that Parker and his team have put in the movie and laced throughout it. And the dialogue, I think, is cracking. But it's also a very quiet, muted movie with a lot of space to explore. It's a very ambient film. And, you know, when you have that space for the audience, it's my favorite kinds of films. You kind of build a relationship with the movie. Not everything is answered upon first watch. You have to keep going back into that world and re-exploring it, looking around. And you find your own meaning. I think people come out of Angel Heart, the hardcore fans, each with a different kind of perception of what the movie's about or what they got out of it. And I think some of the best art is created by accident, you know, as opposed to having it shoved down your throat. All the literal meanings of that you're trying to, you know, too much exposition, too much dialogue that's trying to hammer home every point. This Angel Heart's not interested in that. It's using the original story as a framework in order to build a universe for these characters kind of to inhabit and explore. And all the characters are good. I mean, not just the characters, but all the character actors in it. You know, Brownie McGee is Toots Sweet, is amazing in it. Charlotte Rampling is in it for a very minimal amount of time, but she's incredibly effective as this woman who had this love affair with this man, and you're never quite sure what the relationships are between her and her father. Nothing is spelled out. Everything is ambiguous, and there's so much room for you to draw your own conclusions. And that's due to Parker. That's due to the cast. That's due to the characters. That's due to the writing. It's due to a myriad of things. And I just think it has this amazing power. So what you see in it, it's in the eye of the beholder, I think, ultimately.
Absolutely. I agree. And you did mention Identity, and I can't help but think about that ending, you know, the revelation to Harry. That sequence is devastating, you know, not just because it's a twist, but, you know, I think because of our investment in Angel as a character, you know, Rourke's reaction is truly upsetting and haunting. And, you know, that scream and his shouting, "I know who I am." And that's one thing I wanted to ask. Do you think that line, "I know who I am," is referring to the revelation that he is Johnny Favorite, or is he denying that? You know, "I know who I am," meaning I am Harry Angel, not Johnny Favorite. You know, the following moments would seem to suggest the latter when he insists to Cypher that, you know, he's trying to frame him even as he's, you know, crying. But in the moment, you know, I wonder if it's not the former, you know, the realizing what his true identity is.
Yeah, I've never even thought about that before. Literally, I've never even considered that. And that's really a great takeaway, because I've always, to me, I'm so swept up in the plight of this genuinely good man suddenly realizing that he's a genuinely horrible person who's done horrible things, and completely confused. And I mean, there's the stairs in the fragmented broken mirror where he's all bisected, and that's really the state of his mind. He can't make sense of any of this, and I feel so sad for him, what's left of him. Because, you know, Harry Angel, the real Harry Angel, was just this young boy, this young soldier who was celebrating the end of the war, or was celebrating New Year's Eve, wasn't that it, in Times Square?
Yes.
Yeah, and just was kind of lured and led on, and he was just a boy, and he was murdered. And suddenly his somehow, whatever his essence was, is now grafted onto this personality of this monster. And for him to sort of be at that crossroads where he's coming to terms with the fact of what he is. The scream, I always presumed that was Harry Angel trying desperately to hold on to the last semblance of what he imagined he was. Well, Favorite slowly comes to terms with the fact that, yeah, I guess I am this guy. I get it now. I mean, there's two people living inside that body, which is remarkable. It's the duality of what we are. You know, I mean, no person is pure. We're all an amalgam of good and bad, whether we acknowledge it or not. You know, we go around in our life pretending that, or we think we're the characters in our own movie. And I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're Hitler. You still think what you're doing is right. You're righteous in your belief. You think that you're doing something good. And that's, people are fundamentally good in the sense that we think we are. And then where there's no diabolic people really who wake up going, "I'm going to be evil today." They don't, you know, and people are always struggling with their duality. And that's what, again, I think the beauty of the film is that here's a character who is suddenly thrust right in his face that he is legitimately two people that are completely polar opposite. And how does he make peace with that? So I don't know. Maybe that scream, that it's a really interesting take on it, that scream really is him suddenly waking up his Favorite. I don't think it is, because when he goes back to the motel at the end, or the hotel, and he's so worn down and beaten down, he just kind of throws his hands up and realizes what's going to happen, and he's going to hell. But I still see Harry Angel in his face, in his eyes, you know.
You know, it is curious. I wonder, what is your feeling about the nature of Johnny Favorite possessing Harry Angel, as it were? Do you feel as though his soul has been grafted onto Angel's? Do you think that what was Harry Angel, I mean, if we're talking the soul, do you think Harry Angel still resides somewhere in there? And if so, is he getting dragged to hell right along with Johnny Favorite? Or do you think the Harry Angel is completely gone and Favorite is merely, you know, inhabiting another man's body and memories?
That's the beauty of the film, is that the gynecology, the mechanics of the actual rituals and the voodoo there is unknowable. I mean, it only exists in the confines of this film. So the ritual of eating a heart and assuming an identity, whatever that means, maybe it's based in something legitimate, you know, some kind of ritual, I don't know. But it never spells that out for you. You're never sure. You don't know. And when he's going down to that hell at the end, you're not sure if Harry and Johnny are both going to hell and what will happen next. You don't know. And that's the tragedy of the film. You know, I think it's a really tragic, tragic film, a very sad movie. And I love the fact that it doesn't spell any of that out. The ritual is irrelevant. You don't really need to know any of that. You just have to feel sad about the loss of somebody good succumbing to ultimate evil at the end. And the morality of it. I just think there's so much going on in there that the actual nature of the act itself and what that means, I think, is kind of irrelevant.
You know, talking again about that final scene. Rourke is so great in that moment. But also, you know, De Niro's final appearance, I think, is utterly chilling, you know, with his hair let down and that sort of knowing smile on his face. And that first line is so cruel and yet, you know, darkly funny in a way. How terrible is wisdom when it brings no profit to the wise? There's a mean-spirited nature, I think, to the end of that movie that really has an impact, I think.
Yeah, it was a mean-spirited nature to the whole thing. I mean, the devil's playing him, and at the end he punishes him. I mean, he just that's it. It's like, now you're going to get the ultimate punishment because I fucked with you. And I just – it's great. But then, you know, what's great about De Niro too is that he's throughout the movie, right? Like when you see that there's a – we presume is a woman in black sitting there in the rain as in New Orleans with her head down. I think it's like, what is it, a nun or something? And at the end the head lifts up and it looks up, and that's De Niro, right? Am I mistaken? Or that is, right?
A
clean-shaven De Niro looks up. He's basically to allude to the fact that the devil has been with him the whole time and has helped guide his hand to commit these murders and has been basically tailing him, you know, the private eye who thinks he's on the case and following and these people and coming to all these conclusions has actually been followed the entire time and tailed by the devil himself because he's always been there. He's with him the whole time.
I feel like a complete dunce. I need to revisit the movie again.
Yeah, go back to it, and like especially towards the end when he starts to run back to the hotel room. You'll see the character in black sitting in the kind of passes them, and the head goes up a little bit, and that's De Niro. You know, they don't spell it out too much, but it's him. You see the mole, you see everything. That's Bobby De Niro. So it's a great kind of little like, ah, the devil's always been here, although he's been with him the entire time. He's been pulling the strings. And
it's such a terrible additional twist of the knife, I think, in that ending. Not only is Harry Angel Johnny Favorite, but Angel has been murdering all of his witnesses, you know, throughout the course of the movie. And I believe, you know, it's not that way in the novel, if I recall. Wasn't it suggested that Cypher himself had been committing the murders, but, you know, he was actually planning on framing Angel? Whereas in the film, I mean, we get those terrible flashes when we discovered that it was Angel all along.
Yeah, smoking the cigarette after he's cut off Tootsweet's dick and everything. Yeah, it's pretty upsetting stuff. I don't remember if the novel was that it was Cypher. I mean, I know the Cypher character is a much more prominent figure in the novel, and he's got kind of like a sideshow, and he appears in different incarnations as a mystic, and there's a much deeper role for Cypher, which you don't need. You know, that's the great thing about Angel Heart, too, is that I think if you adapted Falling Angel verbatim, it'd be a much different film, and I don't think it would be nearly as successful because what works on page doesn't necessarily work on screen, and I think Parker was really wise to do what he did with this movie. And I really want to go back to the music, too, because I don't know if you have it, but I bought the soundtrack years ago on CD. I think it's out of print now, but obviously you can find it anywhere from YouTube to iTunes onward. But the you know, the Trevor Horn and Courtney Pine. The soundtrack released by Island Records, I think in 88, is a concept album. It's basically one track. Do you know about this? Have you heard it?
No, not at all.
Yeah, you got it. If you go on YouTube, it's there actually. And it is if the movie is an impression of reading the novel, then the soundtrack is an impression of watching the movie, an oral impression. So it's the entire soundtrack from the beginning with the whispers and little bits of dialogue as it moves, and then the blues music is filtered in through the drones, key bits of the plot. So it is literally like listening to a fever dream version of the film. One track, 45 minutes long. It's fucking stunning. And you really get a chance to really appreciate the oral, the sonics of the film and how effective and instrumental, literally, they are in creating the film's atmosphere. Because to me, I mean, it's one of the greatest scores of all time. It's very muted, but that use of that dissonant saxophone and the way it's quoting that innocuous big band tune, I mean, I just think, and then the way the big band tune ties into the 78 record spinning towards the end, everything is so linked up by sound. Hey, Harry Angel's entire quest is linked by sound. It's a miraculous thing. It's absolutely essential companion to the film for you to have and absorb that soundtrack. So I urge everybody listening to this after they've seen the movie to go out and find a way to experience that soundtrack.
And, you know, that score really helps sort of sell the melding of those genres, I think, you know, noir and horror. And, you know, I was wondering, can you think of any other noir horror films that are sort of standouts to you?
Well, I mean, I remember the Polanskis, and there's a lot of Polanski. I just watched Rosemary's Baby again this morning while I was working, and I always get caught up in it. But there's a lot of, you know, with all Polanski's movies, there's always a feeling of something is wrong in the world. Even when something innocuous is happening, it doesn't feel right. And I think that there's a lot of the Tenant in Angel Heart. It feels a lot, reminds me a lot of the kind of dark chemistry, alchemy that's happening in The Tenant. But The Tenant is a little bit more humorous because it's Polanski. But I remember years later, Johnny Depp was in The Ninth Gate, and that was a Polanski film. And there were moments where The Ninth Gate threatened to be Angel Heart-esque, but it was just too goofy. I mean, it spells things out too much. There's too many weird tangents, too many eccentric characters. It's its own thing, but I was really disappointed in the sense that it really could have been a serious-minded amalgam of horror and noir, and it just went into too many different realms there. You know, I can't think of a movie that captures that feeling of, I mean, there's certain horror films that have, so I think Angel Heart's a noir with horror elements. I think that there's a lot of horror films that have noir elements in them. I'm thinking of Tom Eberhardt's Soul Survivor from 1983.
I just revisited that earlier this month.
Do you get a sense, I mean, when you, from the music to the feeling of it, I mean, there's absolutely no connection between the two films that I know of at all. But there's a sense of kind of loneliness, of loss, of mystery and ambiguity, and a feeling of dread and death and impending doom that's all over both movies. And both of them have these kind of drone-heavy soundtracks, minimal dialogue. Both of them are about a character, you know, trapped by destiny and down-spiraling to her doom or his doom. And, you know, a Soul Survivor opens up on a street with, you know, rain-swept neons, you know, traffic lights reflecting off neon streets, dead storefront windows. There's this feeling of atmosphere and time and place, almost like a haunted version of the real world that I think I feel the same way when I watch that I do when I watch Angel Heart. And then the other film is key moments in Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut. Which I read as a noir, which I read as a satire, which I read as a horror film, also feel like Angel Heart. You know, Tom Cruise running around that fake version of New York.
Oh, absolutely.
To me, feel exactly like Harry Angel trapped in these kind of dream state versions of New Orleans or Brooklyn. I mean, there's kind of the same kind of vibe I get. The same, I can't even articulate, I don't even know what the word is that I come away from that, except for haunting. I just feel incredibly haunted by these movies. And I feel like I've dreamt them. I mean, I've seen Angel Heart so many times, and yet when I flash it back in my mind, I can't hold on to anything tangible. It all feels like fading remnants of a dream, you know? And there are a series of horror films out there that certainly have that same majesty, but I can't think of any noirs that with the horror elements that do what Angel Heart does. It is, as I said at the opening of our chat, yeah, I think it's a fascinating one shot.
Yeah, I agree. And I can't think of any better way to wrap up than that. I think that's about our time. So can I ask, where can folks find you at online, and what can they keep an eye out for from you in the future?
Well, it's funny. I made three movies, and all three of them are, you know, Angel Heart's a huge influence, for the soundtracks especially, because I drove my music. And I try to create the same kind of sense of ambiguity and unease in my films. I think sometimes marginally successfully, but, you know, you're trapped by what you have. Do the best with what you have. So my third film, Female Werewolf, is out now. You can get it on Amazon Prime, or you can order it on Blu-ray or DVD. It's from Artsploitation and Filmrise. And then I just wrapped my next movie, Blood Dynasty, which is another one of my weird dream state female lesbian vampire movies. Filmed that, finished it on the weekend, and I'm in the process of assembly cut right now. And that will probably come out soon. And then I'm starting another movie, science fiction serial killer movie, in a couple weeks. So there's a bunch of movies coming out, and some more music, another album coming out by my label, Giallo Disco, in the future, and my magazine, Delirium, and shocktillyoudrop.com, all kinds of crap out there. But best thing to do is probably just go to chris-alexander.ca, my vanity site where I occasionally update it and let people know who care what's going on.
Excellent. All right. Well, thanks again so much, sir. I appreciate your being on and for choosing Angel Heart. It was great to talk about, and it was great to revisit again. I hadn't seen it in a few years, and it was a lot of fun seeing it again and chatting at length about it.
Well, I haven't seen it myself in about a year, and now talking about it. I'm all excited, so I'm actually going to watch it tonight again. So thank you for re-inspiring me to be inspired.
Thanks again, and thanks to all you listeners out there. As always, make certain to like, subscribe, share, leave us a comment in the section below. Maybe leave us a review on iTunes. Check out our YouTube show. If we get enough views, we may make more someday. Be sure to buy Angel Heart and Mr. Alexander's films using the links below. Remember, any purchase you make through our Amazon links keeps this podcast running, so thanks in advance for that. And we still have that Audible deal going. Sign up for a free 30-day trial. Get 2 free books. Until next time, gang, thanks so much, and have a great weekend.
You gotta burn for this, Angel.
In hell.